Growing Forward, a podcast about all things cannabis in New Mexico. Growing Forward is a collaboration between New Mexico PBS and New Mexico Political Report. I'm Megan Kamrick, a New Mexico PBS correspondent and news director at KUNM-FM.
And I'm Andy Lyman with New Mexico Political Report. Welcome back to all of our longtime listeners and to first-time listeners. We're glad you found us. This is the start of our fourth season, and up until now, we haven't really ever taken a deep dive into the science of cannabis.
We've visited a testing lab and talked with a couple of medical professionals about cannabis, but for a while, we've both wanted to better understand more about how our brains interact with cannabis in all its forms.
We'll dive into the world of cannabis science in just a bit, but first we should catch everyone up on how cannabis fared during the 30-day legislative session that ended in February.
Among other issues like crime, voting rights, and the state's budget, lawmakers were faced with a bill that aimed to clean up the existing Cannabis Regulation Act. The bill stalled in the last days of the session for a number of reasons.
Senate Bill 100 had sort of a slow start, considering that the legislature only had 30 days to get through stacks of legislation. The bill would have done several things, but the big stuff was increasing production limits for microproducers and also allowing them to wholesale with other companies. The bill ultimately was left hanging in a House committee right before the House started a marathon floor session that lasted about 24 hours.
To better understand the implications of SB 100, we spoke with Cannabis Control Division Director Kristen Thompson. Here she is explaining more about what the bill would have done if it passed and what its failure means for the industry.
Senate Bill 100 was really aimed at two things. One, cleaning up the language so that we can do a more in-depth background check. And then the other piece was for the current retailers or the legacy operators. We wanted to work with them to clarify how they go about selling their business or not selling their business, but transitioning from a not-for-profit to a for-profit, and how do we transition that license?
Part of what seemed to spur Senate Bill 100, at least the production increase, was an emergency rule that allows a temporary plant increase for non-micro producers. Those companies can now grow up to 20,000 plants. So what is the outlook on supply right now?
We have seen a number of producers actually that had the ability to expand quickly, put more plants in the ground. Obviously, the harvest on those does not happen immediately. It is a plant. And the intent of the increase was not targeted at April 1, but making sure that there was adequate supply in the days and months to come.
I think 200 plants is the maximum for microproducers right now. It would have gone to 1,000 if this legislation had passed. Is there anything by way of rulemaking that the division can do to sort of help out those microproducers? I mean, obviously, it's written into statute, right?
Right. The plant limit is written into statute. It's certainly unfortunate that the statute was not amended during the session, but the Cannabis Control Division remains as committed as we ever have been in supporting small local entrepreneurs starting out in the industry. In the next few weeks, the application process for the nation's first ever cannabis microbusiness loan program, which is contained within the NMFA, can never remember what that stands for, but
New Mexico Finance Authority.
Thank you. So that loan program will begin. It gives small producers and businesses the chance to access needed capital. And the Cannabis Control Division will also do our best in leveraging our rulemaking authority to help position micro producers that are interested in expanding their businesses so that they can jump in when we are able to increase that plant count and be prepared, ready to go at that juncture. I think we all are aware that increasing space and building out your cultivation is often a capital intensive, and plants do take a while to grow. We want to make sure that everybody is successful, and we are here to help with the future expansion for our micro producers.
So I did speak with Matt Munoz of Carver Family Farm, who we've heard from a lot in the podcast. He sort of, and I think his comment was sort of hypothetical, but he had mentioned to me, you know, for $5,000, I can just go get a non-micro license. practically speaking, if somebody wanted to do that, what would that process be? Would they have to go through the whole thing all over again? Could they contact you all and say, I actually just want to change my paperwork a little bit?
We are actually working out a mechanism right now to address that. The intent is not to make anybody go through the whole application process again. But as you are probably aware, the state agencies are responsible to the legislature when it comes to funding and finances. So we've got to make sure that everything that we are working on can be audited and tracked. And at the end of the day, that financial transaction, we really need to be secure about so that we can report back to the taxpayers of New Mexico.
Just a quick note for listeners. We heard Kristen talk about a state-backed loan program, which we'll get to in a future episode. And another key issue that came out of Senate Bill 100 not passing is that certain wholesale transactions are limited for microproducers. We'll also explore what that means for those producers in a future episode.
As much as I hate to admit it, sometime last year I discovered the TikTok app.
Say it's not so, Andy.
And while I'm sure that that admission will get some eye rolls from listeners, I did find that there is a lane of TikTok that can actually be very informative, which is how I found today's guest.
Additional plans, people often ask me what is so special about cannabis. And shockingly, the answer is not that we just get high from it, but it's how we get high from it. We're able to get high from cannabis.
That's Dr. Riley Kirk. She's got a PhD in pharmaceutical sciences and is an all-around expert in cannabis chemistry. Since cannabis sales are slated to start on April 1st, we thought it would be a good time to learn more about the science behind cannabis and get some tips for those who might be visiting a dispensary for the first time, or those who may have tried cannabis in a previous life and are curious about trying it again.
Riley, along with Dr. Miyabi Shields, also has a podcast, which we'll talk about a little bit later. The two also work together at Real Isolates, a cannabis company that developed a product called Smokinol, which is a cannabis extract that is supposed to have a similar effect to smoking cannabis.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Riley.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm stoked to be here.
There's a whole lot we want to get to in this conversation, but first, can we get into your background a little bit? Can you walk us through sort of what led you to these studies and what those studies mean? What does it mean to study the science of cannabis?
Yeah, so what led me here is I did get my PhD in pharmaceutical sciences. I specialized in natural product chemistry. During my time in graduate school, I studied hundreds of different plants, the compounds that these different plant families made, what makes them unique, how they interact with the body. But cannabis is special because our body has an endocannabinoid system. It's a system that regulates many other things, which is why cannabis has so many therapeutic benefits. It's because the endocannabinoid system is interlinked with so many other systems in your body. So what led me to studying cannabis is actually, I started doing education TikToks just during the pandemic, talking about cannabis, and another researcher named Dr. Miyabi Shields, they found my TikTok, and they were really intrigued with the way I was presenting the information and how passionate I was about cannabis, and they reached out to me and wanted to meet up for lunch. We met up. We were incredibly compatible, just the way we thought about natural products, the way we thought about cannabis as medicine, and the way we thought about communication. So I interviewed with their company, and they hired me on as a cannabis research scientist. We study essentially the compounds in smoked cannabis specifically and how we can bring that to people in a healthier way, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little more later. So a lot of our studies are focusing currently just on understanding how compounds change when they're smoked, but also publishing just some smaller papers on just things people want to know about cannabis. Almost like, I don't want to say myths, but it's kind of is a Mythbuster thing that we're doing. Some of the research just to, you know, relate with the community better and say, we are part of this community and we want to study things that are happening in the community.
I'm sure a lot of our listeners know at least a little bit about the different effects of smoking cannabis versus ingesting it. Can you explain how things like edibles interact with the human body and how that differs from the effects of smoking cannabis?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure many listeners have experienced the differences before because they're very different effects. So the first thing that you might have noticed is the time of onset. So when you smoke or vape, you're feeling those effects within minutes, almost immediately, right? That's because when you're smoking, those cannabinoids and other compounds are being absorbed through your lungs, going into your bloodstream, and then your brain. It's kind of immediate. Whereas when you eat an edible, that is now being processed by your body. So your liver, especially, the purpose of your liver is kind of get things ready for excretion because it's in your body, it needs to get out of your body. But part of what the liver does is it changes compounds just a little bit to make them easier to excrete. So when THC is metabolized in the liver, part of it is changed into different molecules. One of those molecules is what we call 11-hydroxy-THC. And I hate to get too sciencey here, but we kind of have to for a second. So after it's metabolized, you have THC, 11-hydroxy-THC, and another metabolite, among others, that are now floating around in your bloodstream. That's now going to get to your brain still because it's in your bloodstream. And 11-hydroxy-THC has actually been shown to cross your blood-brain barrier faster than THC and bind to your CB1 receptor better, meaning you actually feel a little more high from the metabolite of THC compared to the actual normal molecule, THC. So you might feel a little more high when you take edibles. It's going to take a lot longer to actually set in. And compared to flower, or just, yeah, if you were just smoking flower, flower has many, many different compounds. You can think of it that the plant is producing those compounds in a natural ratio that it needs to survive. And it has, you know, hundreds of different compounds in it. Many times edibles are made with just THC. So we call that isolate, or sometimes THC distillate, which is almost isolate. So that also leads to different effects, because if you think, if you just have THC interacting with your brain, or THC and 11-hydroxy-THC, that's going to feel different than having 100 cannabinoids interacting with your brain, as in the case with some flower. So that like chemical diversity is also adding to difference of effects between edibles and smoking.
We are just weeks away from non-medical cannabis sales here in New Mexico, and I'm sure that will also come with a lot of people either getting back into using cannabis or trying it for the first time. What kinds of questions should these folks be asking at their local dispensaries? When, what sort of things should they consider when they're deciding between different consumption methods?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different options at dispensaries now. So a lot of people don't like smoking. So if you don't like smoking, then don't do it. There's plenty of other ways. Vaping is a very popular method, although a lot of people are a little hesitant with vaping because of some studies that have come out about it being potentially harmful to the lungs or heavy metals getting into your body, which is totally understandable. And that's mostly referring to the concentrates, the ones that come like in a little cartridge. Those are also quite expensive, but there are some really high-end ones of those that maintain the terpene profile, which is a different class of compounds found in the cannabis plant that also have therapeutic benefits. But you can also dry herb vape. So that's when you actually are using flower and you buy a vape and you put the flower in the vape instead of a concentrate. So you don't have to worry about like residual solvents. You're actually putting the flower into the vape and then it vapes it to a very specific temperature. So you're still getting all of those cannabinoids and terpenes, but you don't have to worry about all those other confounding factors that could be negatively affecting your health. Edibles are a great way for a discreet method of using cannabis. But again, keep in mind that is going to take a while to feel the effects. So if you're looking for a more immediate effect, could try a tincture. Tinctures are usually oil or alcohol extracts of the cannabis plant. You can put tinctures in like a drink or something like that to ingest them, but you can also just take it and put it right under your tongue. doesn't always taste fantastic. So fair warning there. But that will help you feel the effects much sooner because you're actually absorbing right below your tongue. So it doesn't need to go through the body like other processes. There's also some dispensaries that have capsules. So it looks like a traditional pill essentially, but there's extract inside. So that's really easy to dose. But again, that's going to take a while to feel the effects. And then a lot of people, if you have arthritis or something that's like pain related to a specific area, people use topicals a lot. So that's cannabis that's put into a cream or a salve or a gel or something like that, that you can put right directly on your skin. And that is also supposed to help the pain associated with a localized area. With any product you're taking, specifically high in THC, you always want to start with the lowest possible dose that you can. So, you know, if I was taking an edible and I bought it at a dispensary and the normal serving was like a 10 milligram cube, I wouldn't take that full 10 milligrams. I wouldn't even take half. I would probably take a quarter of that and then say, do I feel the effects of this? I always recommend keeping a journal or something so you can actually remember the things that you're testing on yourself. And then if you don't feel the effects of that, try a half. If you don't feel the effects of that, try three quarters. And then if you don't feel the effects of that, or if you want more effects, you can try the full 10 milligrams. We call this titrating your dose. You always want to keep your dose as low as possible because you can build a tolerance to the effects of these cannabinoids. And that's just going to require more and more product. And you don't really want that. So keeping a low dose is optimal if you can.
I'm sure this varies widely based on people's size, their body chemistry, but when we're talking about it's going to take a while for the effects of edibles, I mean, is there any kind of standard or formula? Like if you weigh this much, you know,
it could be completely different. And the way the edible is made could also affect that, just, you know, what oils are present, things like that. But the window's large. It could be like 30 minutes to 2 hours. So it really depends on you, your metabolism, not just your body weight, like how fast you metabolize compounds, other genetic components. There's a lot of nuances on how you could feel different based on your body.
I think this might touch on your current work, but I personally have seen so many press releases and news stories about these companies that have developed, you know, new edibles or tinctures that, you know, reportedly hit you faster. Is that really a thing? And if so, how does it work?
Yeah. So like nano emulsions are the words that they use for this. Essentially there's multiple components here. So yeah, we're trying to get edibles to act faster because nobody wants to wait 2 hours to feel the effects of something, especially if you're a medical patient. You know, you'd have to really space out your doses perfectly to continue getting the benefits. So these nano emulsions are ways to essentially encapsulate the cannabinoids and other active molecules and then put them into a solution so that they can essentially kind of bypass the metabolism from your liver so that they can just kind of go into the bloodstream and then enter the brain. I do think we need a lot more research on this before we can make some of the claims we are making. But I think if we were able to do it, it would be very important. But this technology also has a lot of purposes when we look into cannabis beverages. So I don't know if you guys have seen, they look like sodas, they look like seltzers, they're cannabis beverages. Again, so cannabinoids are lipophilic, meaning they like fat, they like fatty things. But when we think of those beverages, you're not drinking a can of butter, you're going to be drinking something watery. So a huge obstacle was, how do we get these fatty molecules into this watery matrix? Because it's like oil and vinegar, they want to just separate right out. So part of this nanoemulsion technology is being able to essentially encapsulate the cannabinoids, but make them soluble into water. And now we can release these drinks that are they taste like a normal drink, but they have these little nano encapsulated cannabinoids in them floating around that will enter your body and hopefully act a lot quicker than other consumption methods like edibles.
So it's like boba tea? No, I'm just kidding.
Kind of. That's like a giant version of it.
Yeah. Since we've started this podcast, we've heard over and over about the lack of cannabis research. How have you seen that change over the years?
Yeah, so I mean, it's still struggling for sure, but we're seeing a huge uptick, and it's predicted to be a lot bigger. And part of that reason, I'll start with, previously, if you wanted to study cannabis, you had to get that cannabis from the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss. They were the only ones that were able to grow the cannabis, and they had this huge field, but it did not represent what was available on the market at all, both with like diversity of compounds, THC percentage, et cetera. It wasn't what was available to consumers. So how is it relevant for research? So within, I think, the last year, it might have been 2 years, kind of lost track with the pandemic. Within the last 2 years, it's now available for other universities to start cultivating cannabis. And this has definitely led to a lot more research, because now they can say, okay, I want to study specifically this strain and the effects of this strain on this endpoint. And now we're able to do that. And we don't have that huge hurdle of having to go through Ole Miss and having to get the cannabis from there. And I know, have you guys heard of Delta 8 THC?
A little bit.
Yeah, so it's an isomer, so it's slightly different chemical compound of THC. But because it's slightly different, it kind of fits in this loophole where you're allowed to use it legally in most states, and you're allowed to research using it. So although there's a lot of controversy with Delta 8 THC, I think it's been very beneficial for research purposes, because even if we weren't allowed to use Delta 9 THC, which is the THC everyone's used to seeing, even if we're not allowed to use that for research, we were able to use Delta 8 THC. And that has been really helpful as like an academic loophole and a loophole for people trying to get cannabis medicine for studying it. But I think, you know, as states are starting to legalize it, as countries are starting to legalize it, we're going to see just an absolute boom of the cannabis research. And we're understanding the endocannabinoid system a lot better, which is going to lead, again, to a lot more research and understanding how certain cohorts of people can benefit from certain cultivars or strains of cannabis. I think that's where like the personalized cannabis medicine is really going to start taking off. You know, if they'll say, okay, if you have this specific condition, try this specific strain of cannabis because it has these molecules in higher ratios, and that's going to interact with your body more and provide you more with what you need.
You mentioned Delta 9, and I believe it's legal here in New Mexico, as most other places. Is there a difference of how it makes you feel?
Delta 8 THC compared to Delta 9 THC.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, just to reinforce this, Delta 9 THC is the one that you're used to seeing everywhere, the THC that most people are referring to. The reason we're saying Delta 8 and Delta 9, that Delta refers to a location of a double bond in the molecule, which is like crazy science-y for most, you know, most cannabis people, just because we usually don't pay attention to the chemistry that much. But essentially, this slight modification of the position of that double bond, it does decrease the activity of that molecule on the CB1 receptor in our brain. So it is less psychoactive than Delta 9 THC. However, it still definitely is. I have tried Delta 8 THC multiple times. It's a little overpowering for me because I'm someone who likes flower. I don't love edibles made with isolate. And those Delta 8 gummies were made with isolate. If you see Delta 8 flower, like flower being sold that says like Delta 8 flower, that's usually like sprayed with Delta 8 THC, because Delta 8 THC is typically made synthetically, whereas Delta 9 THC is usually like isolated from the plant. Now, Delta 8 THC is a naturally occurring compound, but it's mostly a breakdown product of other compounds. So nobody's isolating the Delta 8 THC used for the gummies you're seeing or the flower or anything. That's just a synthetic product where they take CBD, expose it to heat and acid, and turn it into Delta 8 THC. So I think there's a lot of misconceptions thinking that Delta 8 is a naturally, like, it's just naturally coming from the plant, isolated, made into gummies like you're traditionally seeing, but it's not. It is a synthetic product about 99.9% of the time.
I think this is actually a good segue to the next question. I remember at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, hearing about studies that reportedly showed cannabis could help prevent COVID. But more recently, there were a couple more studies about cannabis and COVID. Can you walk our listeners through what these studies found?
Totally. And I'm going to kind of give an abridged version just because I don't want to get too in depth of the science. But if you find it interesting, I have like very long YouTube videos dissecting all of this. So essentially, the first paper that came out was published in the Journal of Natural Products by Van Breemen and colleagues. And what they were doing is they were screening a bunch of different compounds from the hemp plant to see if any of them could bind to a part of the spike protein. So essentially what their thought was, they were trying to prevent the virus from entering your cells, because if the virus couldn't enter the cells, it couldn't infect you, essentially. So the way the viral spike protein interacts with the ACE2 receptor on the human cells, and they kind of like link together, and that allows the virus to enter the cell. Their thought was, if we could find a compound from hemp cannabis that could bind to a part of the spike protein, that would prevent it from being able to bind to the ACE2 receptor, and that would prevent it from entering your cells. So they screened a bunch of different compounds, and they found that CBDA and CBGA were able to bind to that portion of the spike protein and prevent viral entry. Now, there's a few things in this paper to note before we kind of get into the details. And one of those is all of the data presented is what we call in vitro data. It means like it was in a test tube. It's in a laboratory in very isolated conditions. We don't know if these results are translatable to humans. We don't fully understand the complexity of the human body, nor the complexity of the hemp plant. So before, you know, I think people got really, really excited about this, and it is really exciting, but we need to be careful with, you know, how we interpret that data. This is just a piece of the puzzle. And something very important that they found is that the dose required to prevent that viral entry is very high. And we don't even know if it's possible to get the human plasma levels of CBDA or CBGA that high in the body. And we don't know if it's safe to get those levels that high. So if you're just taking these, if you're taking a tincture every day in your coffee, you're taking probably orders of magnitude less than what would be effective for these assays that they were testing. Assays, just a laboratory test.
I think I'd seen one of your videos that essentially, like, I forget which one it was, a study that showed that the compound is basically something that you can only get from, I forget how you described it, maybe soaking the flower in alcohol, right?
Totally. Yeah. So I think when you say something like CBGA or CBDA, people usually are just going to group that with CBD and CBG because those are the words we're used to seeing, but they're very different. So CBDA, CBGA, THCA, all of those A's mean acid. So CBD acid. So they're containing a component of that molecule that's not present in most of the products that you're taking. However, the acidic molecules are what the plant's making. So when you look at a nug of weed, you're looking at all those acidic cannabinoids in there. So in that nug are the active compounds against COVID from the study. However, when you smoke a joint or smoke a bowl or whatever, you're lighting that on fire, which is releasing that acid. So the molecule entering your body is not CBDA, it's just CBD. So then a lot of people say, oh, cool. So you're just telling me to take a tincture. No, because although you're not lighting your tincture on fire, somebody else has already activated those molecules for you, the person who made that tincture. So what they did when they were making that tincture or when they were making that edible, they took the flower that they were going to use and they put it into an oven and they heated it up for a certain amount of time at a certain temperature, and that releases those acids. So then after those acids are released, they're going to take that and extract it and make it into a tincture. But the reason that we usually activate it in an oven or with fire is because those compounds, for every other purpose other than this COVID study, are much more active in our body. So for instance, THCA does not make you feel high at all. But once you light it on fire, release that acid, or activate it in an oven, the THC does make you feel high. And this is the same for many other cannabinoids, like CBDA is less active in our body for many things. But once we remove that acid, then CBD is active for many things in our body for therapeutic purposes. So if we think of like 99% of the reasons that we're using these compounds, we want to remove that acid. But now this paper is saying that if we want the benefits from what they're saying, we can't remove that acid. So if you don't want to remove that acid, you would take those nugs from the plant in their raw form and extract them in alcohol or oil or something like that. And then you maintain that acid component of the molecule. You just can't expose it to heat because that's when you're removing that acid component. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And then again, it sounds like it would be like you talked about the quantities. There's not really, we can't really get it in those larger quantities to make an actual effect according to the studies.
Right. They showed a little bit of data with some monkey studies that were done in the past showing like, all right, this is probably possible, but we don't have any data, especially in humans, that say that the levels of these compounds in the blood plasma are possible.
I think I heard you say a few minutes ago another study you were going to talk about, and I just wanted to give you a chance to.
Oh yeah, I'll be relatively brief about that one. So that is the second paper that was published. That was in Science Advances, but I think it was Nguyen and colleagues published that one. That is a really cool paper that has completely different results, but they don't cancel out each other. It's not, the second paper doesn't say the first one isn't true. They were looking at different endpoints, so. The second paper was essentially saying, confirming the results of the first paper, that the virus can still enter your cell and CBD does not prevent that viral entry to the cell. But once the virus enters the cell, CBD can help stop the viral replication within your cell. So they did a lot of really cool gene studies, understanding how gene expression changes when just CBD is present, when just the virus is present. And then they compared an active molecule, the CBD active molecule, to CBDV, which is an inactive molecule. And they said, okay, what gene changes are we seeing that CBD can do that CBDV cannot do? And it really all pointed towards a certain component of the cell that responds to stress. And CBD was able to activate that part of the cell that responds to stress. And because it activated this portion of the cell, it was able to combat the viral replication of the RNA that it needs to make more of the spike protein, more of the nucleocapsid, more of these really important things for the virus to replicate. CBD was able to stop that replication by just initiating a part of the cell to respond to stress. And once that's initiated, that cell is going to say, okay, this viral RNA is not supposed to be here. So it essentially just like stops the expression, et cetera. And they also found that when people are infected with SARS-CoV-2 virus, a portion of their innate immune system is suppressed. Your innate immune system is the one you're born with. It's innately part of you. So it was able to suppress a part of your innate immune system. But when with CBD present, it was able to essentially upregulate that portion that had been suppressed, which is helping your innate immune system fight off that virus better than if CBD was not present. Now, what's different about this study is, well, I will first say it still requires a very high dose of CBD, not CBDA, CBD for this paper. It still requires a very high dose, but we do know that these levels are possible to get to in the blood, in the plasma, essentially. Compared to the other study, we don't know if it's possible. The threshold here is much lower, and we know it's possible because there's many people that are taking Epidiolex, which is pharmaceutical grade CBD. They take it to prevent seizures. So we know from data from those people that they're taking high levels of CBD every day, but their plasma levels were able to get to the effective concentration. And these researchers also did some animal studies to confirm their results. So although it is a little bit further in the clinical pipeline, we still would need a controlled clinical study with humans to fully understand, you know, specifically how different groups of humans respond to high levels of CBD. And again, CBD interacts with other drugs. So this is something so important for people who are taking, who want to take CBD daily for one reason or the other, whether it's COVID or anxiety. If you're already on something like anxiety medications, CBD can interact with those medications. So it's always recommended that you talk to a doctor before taking CBD, and especially high doses of CBD.
Over the past 2 years, there's been so much misinformation out there about COVID prevention. And I think we're so used to hearing from cannabis proponents about all the great things it can do. Why is it important to make sure people are getting the full story when it comes to studies like the ones you just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, it's very important so people, you know, don't think that just smoking weed every day is going to prevent them from getting COVID. And even, you know, I make these excruciating long videos going into like the detail. I have like PowerPoints. I'm just like talking through all of this. And then people will still just comment and be like, oh, so I should smoke weed that's like, you know, high in CBD. I'm like, no. Oh, so I should just take tinctures. It's like, no. Like it's very hard to explain, because the science that's written is, it's very difficult for most cannabis users. You know, we don't all study the chemistry of cannabis. And when we're talking about acidic cannabinoids or even like Delta 8 THC, all of this stuff is really hard to understand if you've never looked at a chemical structure before. It's nobody's fault for misunderstanding the studies. And there's a lot of viral headlines from very reputable sources that are misleading, and they are part of the problem. They should explicitly say in the headlines that like smoking weed does not protect you from COVID. But instead, it's like these, you know, clickbait headlines that are trying to get people to read them, and they kind of wash away most of the details and just tell people what they want to hear. And I think that's a huge issue with media communication, understanding in general. And especially when we think about smoking weed, a lot of people say, well, I've smoked weed for 30 years and I still haven't got COVID. That's a great anecdotal story, but it doesn't really mean anything. And, you know, both authors of this paper and the next paper I'll discuss, smoking something is going to worsen a respiratory illness. So that's definitely not recommended from either of these authors, regardless of what the study had found.
I think we're probably to a point as a society where we can all stop being embarrassed about looking at TikTok. And I'll admit that I found out about your work through your TikTok videos, I think last year. What made you decide to start making these videos, and what has the response been over the past year?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I've been using cannabis since I was in high school, always loved it, always used it. Found the benefits, and a lot of my family have used it. You know, in grad school, I studied partially hemp was part of my dissertation, but I studied hundreds of other plants. And then part of what I was realizing in grad school was that there was very little reputable information about cannabis science that was on the internet for free. There are some, you know, universities, some institutions that offer cannabis science, cannabis chemistry, cannabis pharmacology for, you know, $5,000. But your average stoner isn't going to go pay $5,000 for a cannabis course that they just want to know more. So my goal is just like to provide the information that I wish I had years ago, and, you know, help people understand the benefits of the plant, the precautions of using cannabis, and just kind of get into the nitty gritty a little more. And I mean, I wasn't expecting anything to happen on TikTok. I mean, it's just a random science lady talking about weed. But then, you know, everyone loves weed. So the first video I made gained a ton of traction. And then after that, it was really cool to interact with people in the comments where, you know, I'd make a video about something, and then at the end, I'll ask, like, how did this make you feel? Or like, what strains would you recommend for this? And people were really into engaging on TikTok and talking and contributing to research. I talked about the edible thing. That's something we just published for a publication. And in that publication, like, I thanked the people on TikTok. They were a huge part of it. They contributed to science. They're helping us get data. So the feedback has been awesome. People are just really thankful for the free information. You know, I don't ask for money or anything from anyone. I literally only ask for people to be respectful, which still doesn't happen sometimes, but that's the internet. So it's been great feedback. I'm really happy I did it. It was a total whim thing. I was just like, I'm gonna make random TikToks because I have nothing else to do. And it's been really great. I mean, the current position I have as a cannabis scientist, I got from TikTok, from Miyabi finding my TikTok and being like, wow, this is cool.
You mentioned Miyabi Shields earlier, and I want to make sure that we, you know, give them their props for all the work they've done as well. You mentioned a little bit how you two connected. How did that work? Was it through TikToks that you two found each other, or?
So I started making my TikToks January of last year. You know, I probably had 20 videos out. And then I think it was around March, Miyabi started making TikToks as well. And Miyabi specialized in the endocannabinoid system. I specialized in plant chemistry. So we were very different, but very compatible. So, you know, a bunch of my followers on TikTok started tagging me in Miyabi's videos when they started making them. And at first I was like, I didn't notice that I was getting tagged in them. And then eventually I was tagged like 20 times in one of their videos. So I looked at it and I was like, oh, this is wicked cool. So then, you know, we started just liking each other's videos, commenting on them, just normal internet relationships, whatever. But in my bio, I had my email if anyone wanted to contact me. So Miyabi sent me an email. At the time, I was living in Rhode Island. They were living in Boston. So we were pretty close geographically. So yeah, we met up for brunch in Newport, Rhode Island, as you know, any good millennial does. We had some avocado toast and coffee and just the topics we were covering. Like, I've never had those conversations with people about science, the direction of academia, the direction of communication. We just really bounced off each other really nicely, and we wanted the same things. Like, our goals were very similar, and that's really how it started. After that, we were like, okay, we really need to work together one way or another. At first, it was just, let's publish a paper together, like a theory paper. And then it kind of turned into, well, I do need a job. So, and then Miyabi had started the company, Real Isolate Smoke and All, just a year before that, approximately a year before that. And, you know, we needed to expand the research component of it, the laboratory research. And we just moved into a research lab 2 weeks ago. So things are finally like moving forward, and we're really excited what we can bring to the world, you know, together, because we are our research interests and just our backgrounds are so compatible that they really make for an interesting perspective to natural product chemistry and cannabis science.
So as we're wrapping up here, where else can folks find your content? I think you and Dr. Shields have a podcast as well, and you mentioned a YouTube channel. Where can folks find your content?
Yeah, so my name is Cannabichem pretty much everywhere, CannabiChem. So you can find my longer videos on YouTube. I kind of recently started that, but there are videos on both COVID studies, and I'm continuing to make more. TikTok is where I make the most videos by far, because it's the easiest. And again, name's Cannabichem. Our podcast, Dr. Shields and I's podcast, is called Smokin' Science. And you can find that on Apple, Spotify, and pretty much every other mainstreaming platform. And then if you also want to keep up to date on our research and our products and everything that we're trying to do with Smokin' All Real Isolates, follow the Smokin' All page on Instagram. We post pretty much everything there. And if you're not into social media, but maybe you're still on LinkedIn, you can follow us on Real Isolates LinkedIn.
So I did see that. Did you get kicked off Instagram on here?
I did get. Oh, I'm on Instagram as well. Sorry. Follow me on Instagram. I did get kicked. I've been kicked off of every platform, but I'm back on Instagram. Yeah, it's the censorship with cannabis is so.
And even in your TikTok videos where you have to add the R to the word cannabis and like
yeah, so like cranobliss, cannobliss, like, I mean, there's so many things that we have to do, which is just so funny looking at the other things happening on the app that's like totally kosher. Everyone's just going for it. But then I'm like talking about the science of cannabis and they're like, nope, you're banned for 2 weeks. I'm like, come on. It's ridiculous. But yeah, even if I'm, you know, banned from one app, I'm always on the other one. So that's why I always tell people to follow me on like Instagram and TikTok, because you never know when I'm just going to poof, be gone.
This has been another episode of Growing Forward. Thanks for listening, and keep an ear out for our next episode in a couple of weeks, when Megan and I will be out talking to folks on the first day of cannabis sales.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Growing Forward, and don't forget to subscribe so you can stay up to date on the latest episodes. And we just launched our Instagram channel. You can search for us at Growing Forward. Special thanks to Catherine Conley, who designed our logo, and thank you to our tireless producer, Kevin McDonald.